And now the third presenter, Johan, is soon on his way.
So my name is Johan Brochet, and I'm a researcher at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University. Currently, I work on two projects, one that deals with South Sudan and what we label something called warlord democrats, which Mimi here also is involved in. And it deals with why some former commanders integrate in the democratic process in a peaceful way, whereas others do not. And another project is called Causes of Peace. The Zambia, Botswana, and Malawi Zone of Peace, and it look into why these countries has remained peaceful in a region where it's very violent. But today I'm going to talk about my dissertation project, and in the brief I've left out almost all of the empirics. So I will deal with some of the empirics here in the presentation, because I think that it's a complement to what's in the report. So the research question that I ask in my dissertation is, why do communal conflict turn violent in some regions but not in others? And the theoretical framework I use brings together Kaleva's elite interaction perspective and Ostrom theories on common pool resources. Sorry, my computer, I just... And although the theory is not the focus here, what is important is that one theory looked into different actors and the other one looks into more into different institutions and the interaction between institutions and actors is important for the... So now I can look at the presentations and you at the same time, I hope. And the method that I use in the dissertation is that I do a structured focus comparison of three different regions in Sudan. When I started the project, it was one Sudan, but afterwards it became two Sudans. So one of the regions are located in South Sudan. And the main conclusion is that the government bias increased the risk of violent communal conflict as it destroys interaction among different elites and make sanctions less graduated, boundaries less well-defined, and rules less related to local conditions. And this dissertation started as I saw an empirical puzzle. I have been dealing with the conflict in Darfur for a long time, and then I was surprised when I heard statements like this. The living conditions are so harsh that the local population has been facing acute poverty, persistent drought and famine, a lack of adequate access to healthcare and education, high levels of unemployment, in addition to land degradation and shrinking pasture areas for a very long time. And mirror images of what has been going on in Darfur over the 10 years until the present escalation of violence out of all imaginable proportions. And these statesmen were about Eastern Sudan, but we didn't hear anything about the communal conflicts in Eastern Sudan. So that's why I was surprised, because a lot of the things that are in these statesmen were said to be the causes of the communal conflicts in Darfur. So this is a map showing the three regions that I compare. And when I discuss the empirics here, I will leave out the Greater Upper Nile region to make it easier to just compare Darfur and Eastern Sudan. But it should be said that when I talk about government bias, it means two different governments, because since 2005, the government of South Sudan has been, it was the ruling government because South Sudan was autonomous before it became independent in 2011. So when I look into government bias, I also started to think about what is the reasons for government bias. And then I found some inspiration by a researcher called Catherine Boone, who states that the reason for government bias are to be found in the complex interplay between the opportunities and threats that a region constitutes. And then when I look into elite interaction, I look into two levels of elite interaction, central elites versus local elites, and local elites versus local elites. And in a communal conflict context, the government is the most important central elite, and the native administrators are the most important local elite. And from Eleanor Ostrom's Common Pool Resources, I derived three different mechanisms: graduated sanctions, clarity of boundaries, and local rules. And to understand how these theoretical mechanisms work in reality, this is just showing what I've already said. We look into the two cases of Darfur and Eastern Sudan. Throughout the studied time period, the government in Khartoum has been much more biased in Darfur than in Eastern Sudan. Darfur has been a larger threat to the government, whereas Eastern Sudan has constituted larger opportunities than Darfur. And this has mainly to do with the threats in Darfur has been different groups that have challenged the government, that have made them to take side with some groups vis-a-vis others. Whereas in Eastern Sudan, it's very important for the regime to stay in control and have fairly stable conditions, because they have a pipeline with the oil going through Eastern Sudan, and all the oil in Sudan are exported in Port Sudan. So that means that they cannot play the same game there. So they have been more not as biased in relation to the different communities. And this bias in that they have dealt with the communities in Darfur has destroyed the interaction between local and central elites, as well as among local in Darfur, whereas in Eastern Sudan, central and local elites cooperate, and Khartoum allows the local elite to play a crucial role. And to see how this has worked more in detail, in Darfur, the government has actively undermined the native administration, which has made this formerly effective arena for conflict resolution ineffective. And local and central elites interact negatively, and there is no autonomy for local conflict resolution mechanisms. There is no local ownership of the different processes between the different communities. Whereas in Eastern Sudan, the native administration work is empowered by the government and works as an effective arena for conflict resolution. And this has led to selective sanctions that contribute to violence in Darfur. And in Darfur, the government has extensively used militias. This has led to selective impunity that relates to what Angela just said, and that sanctions are not graduated, as sanctions depend on the perpetrator's communal affinity rather than the seriousness and context of violation. And this really destroys the interaction. We can take an example of a famous Janjaweed leader called Musa Hilal. He was imprisoned when the conflict in Darfur started in 2003, but he was released in order to make the government stronger. So that has meant that people from some communities, they are not punished when they do things, whereas other people are punished. And in Eastern Sudan, the government, in contrast, acts in a relatively neutral manner and do not have a community that it's constantly ruled against. And that means that sanctions are graduated in this region. And another important difference between these two regions relates to boundaries. In Darfur, boundaries are very unclear, as the government has strategically redrawn territories and administrative units in order to reduce the power of anti-government groups. First, the region of Darfur was one state, then it was divided into three, and now it's divided into five. And we can also see a similar condition taking place in Sudan, where the President Salva Kiir just 1 week ago said that we're going to have 28 dead states instead of 10. And my research shows that this unclarity of boundaries has disastrous effect for communal conflicts because it makes it much harder to find ways to cooperate when the boundaries are unclear. And in Eastern Sudan, some unclarity exists in regard to Masarats, which is roads for pastoralists, but in general, boundaries are fairly clear. And another finding is that local understanding enhances cooperation. In Darfur, rules are unrelated to local condition, as the government do not allow local actors to influence these rules, whereas in Eastern Sudan, local actors are allowed to influence rules and local conditions are reflected in existing rules. There are very many examples of how you can see in Eastern Sudan that the conflicts were there, they started, maybe one or two were killed, but there were local mechanisms there that solved the conflicts. And they could do that because they had some ownership over the process, which they did not have in Darfur. And just to end with some conclusions, I think that it's important to see that communal cooperation is possible even with a widespread lack of resources. So we shouldn't assume that it's only these structural factors that leads to communal conflicts. In Darfur, it was a lot of talk about desertification, scarce resources, and of course, these are very important in a lot of different ways, but they can be dealt peacefully or they can be dealt with in a very violent manner. Because in Eastern Sudan, you have the same scarcity, you have the same problems, but you don't have the same type of conflict, or the conflict doesn't become as violent there. And government bias really destroys peaceful intercommunal relations. We can think of a referee that is always very biased and take decision for one group vis-a-vis another, and it has a very disastrous effect for the relation between the communities. And elites play a key role in fomenting intercommunal violence. To take another example, we can look at the post-election violence in Kenya 2007, where you can see that it was elites at different levels that were really important for this violence. And then finally, I think that it's very important to raise the awareness of the intricate interlinkages between various types of collective violence in order to prevent and manage conflict. If we look into the conflict in Darfur, it's usually stated that it started in 2003, and that when it became interesting for the international community. But you had a lot of communal conflicts taking place prior to that, and it was when the government strongly took side with some of the communities that the other communities formed rebel groups and stated that why should we fight these other communities when it really is the government that it is our problem. So even if we are just interested in state-based violence where the government is involved, we should also look at these more local conflicts because they have the potential to scale up also to war and large-scale fighting as we've seen in Darfur. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now we have a last one before the discussion begins. Mikael.
My name is Mikael Jonsson. I wrote my doctoral dissertation at the Department of Government, where I still currently have a research project on continued reintegration of ex-combatants in Colombia. And what I will do during this briefing is I will firstly quickly summarize the results from my dissertation, which deals with what I call the rebel's life cycle, the motives for recruitment, experiences as a member, and motives for leaving rebel groups, in this case FARC in Colombia. This will be followed by efforts that reintegrate them into civilian life. Just to set the background, this is an estimate of the number of fighters inside FARC. What it shows is from 1982 to 2002, FARC took a decision to get involved in the growing coca economy in Colombia and grew almost exponentially until the end of peace negotiations that were being held between 1999 and 2002. From that point, the recently elected President Álvaro Uribe at the time decided to launch a counterinsurgency operation against FARC. And since then, FARC has been gradually losing fighters, approximately somewhere between half and two-thirds of their fighters. And it is during this period of decline of FARC, which I'm primarily studying in the dissertation. My focus is what happens inside rebel groups during ongoing civil wars. I began my research by doing interviews with fighters all over FARC, and then I've zoomed in on four specific fronts to be able to describe in detail what happens, what kind of experiences do you have, what shapes the way you think about the group, what drives you to defect from the group. At the end of the research, I also was given access to a survey study with 700 fighters from these four fronts. It gives a very detailed view of what occurred inside rebel groups. In the study, I focus on three arguments. First is that the emphasis that rebels join rebel groups due to either political activism or ideology, or due to material incentives, is vastly overstated. This is just one case, but in several surveys of several ex-combatants from armed groups, it's been fairly clear that other motives, such as either personal relations to people who already joined the group, or a very insecure living situation can be equally important. The second was a hypothesis I had that, as you saw, FARC was growing exponentially in terms of fighters. It was also very successful on the battlefield up until 2002. At that point, it seemed very plausible that FARC would win the war. From then on, it's been a constant decline. It's not defeated, but no one believes today that FARC can ever win this conflict militarily, and this is arguably why they're still in peace negotiations today. My idea that I explore is whether this also impacts why people join the group in the first place. And the third argument is different types of rebel units. If you work with financing, or if you work with propaganda, or if you work with combat, you need different kinds of recruits. You should arguably be recruiting different kind of people. This is the three main claims that I explore. And I'll go through this real quickly, but on the first one, when people join FARC, there's a diversity of motives. There was 12 possible responses. There, six of them had more than responses. Importantly, thresholds to enter are very low. People join at the spur of a moment, oftentimes. Going back to Angela's presentation, FARC is much more like FNL, very strict, very hierarchical. You cannot leave. Cannot see your family, you do not get paid and so forth, you might get executed for breaching the discipline. So I asked them time and time again, so knowing this, when you joined, this was a lifetime decision, or at least a life-altering decision. Did you spend a lot of time thinking about this? By and large, most people said, no, I was 15. I didn't think long-term at the time. I got drunk at a party, I woke up, I was a member of FARC. That was perhaps the worst case scenario, but it was very clear that people did not necessarily consider the long-term consequences of this. And once they were inside, it was very hard to leave. It's very difficult and dangerous to leave FARC. You're in a rebel camp inside the rainforest, and if you get caught or you get lost on trying to escape, chances are very high that you might get executed. So people enter without considering for a very long time, but have a very hard time leaving. This is interesting. It's very hard to interpret from you, but what I did here is I studied people who joined when FARC was expanding compared to people who joined when FARC was decreasing. Argument being, if they consider the like the consequences of membership, the reason why they joined should be different between time periods. And the result was that it's 96% probability that they were not different. They were quite similar. And again, this goes back to the idea that people either do not have information about what entails to be a member, or they do not stop to think about it. Once they're inside, they realize much dangerous, how restrictive, but at the time of joining, people mostly did not either know or care. The third theory was that people who join FARC should do so. The recruitment should look different for different groups. And this was true of one front that was a heavily contested area. Control of the region shifted back and forth between FARC and the right-wing paramilitaries. So it was a classic situation where it was more dangerous to be a non-affiliated civilian than it was to be a combatant. Because any time a new group came in, they would suspect you of collaborating with the previous or with their enemies. So here people joined because it was too dangerous to be a civilian many times. For the other three fronts, it was quite clear that what determines discipline and behavior and level of coherence of a rebel unit oftentimes has much more to do with the leadership, the mid-level commanders, if they're being well-treated and so forth. And this, I'll come back to this with Rian, because it carries quite a lot of weight. So we move towards the, as some of you might know, FARC is currently in peace negotiations with in Colombia. And they just had a major breakthrough during their peace negotiations, which means by March 2016, in all likelihood, FARC will sign a peace agreement, ending one of the longest civil wars, not the entire civil war, but the conflict between FARC and Colombian government. This graph here shows, you saw before that FARC has been shrinking quite substantially. Over this time period, more and more combatants have been leaving FARC in spite of this being a very dangerous decision to take. From 2007 to 2010, it was three times more likely that you left FARC, you escaped from it, even though it was dangerous, than that people were lost on the battlefield. So this tells you something about how important combatants' motives and their reason to leave can be for the outcome of an entire conflict. And this is interesting. If you ask combatants, why did you leave FARC? Most of them would say, I missed my mom. Here, it's to be with the family, to regain liberty. If you ask them, how did you leave? It's dangerous, it's difficult. It was much more likely that they realized that it was very dangerous. Either they had stolen something or they had committed some crime inside the group, so they thought they would be punished by the group, or they feared during combat. So people are, a lot of fighters left because they were fearing for their lives. And this makes sense. Since it's so dangerous to leave, and they see people try to escape, be caught, they might be executed, a lot of people want to leave FARC for several years, but never have the courage or have the opportunity to do so. And it actually takes for them to perceive an even greater threat from inside the group to take that step. And just to put this into context, this was an interview done by the Reintegration Office. If you have similar questions asked by the military, a much higher percentage will say, I left because I was afraid of the army or I was being mistreated. So we have to be a little careful when we look at surveys alone. We have, in my dissertation, always go back between surveys on the one hand and in-depth interviews on the other hand. Because depending on who asked the question and how you phrase them, the differences are stark. This goes... There have been two major efforts of reintegration during the last decade in Colombia. The paramilitaries were demobilized mainly between 2004 and 2006. And they had an unofficial peace agreement between the government and the paramilitaries, after which they collectively laid down their arms. This is the traditional DDR approach. You have a peace agreement, and then people disarm, demobilize, and they are reintegrated. Alongside this, the government has also been inviting individual fighters from FARC to leave. They call this DDR, and in some instances it's reintegration. People go through the same programs, are offered education, psychosocial counseling, and so forth. But the process has been quite different, and so has the outcome and the success of these programs. So if you look at the paramilitaries, there was 30,000 people who left in 3 years. They thought that there were 8,000 or 10,000 at most paramilitary fighters. So it's quite likely, it's 100% certain that a lot of people joined these programs who were never paramilitaries. reason being simple, because you bring offered a minimum pay, education, access to job training and so forth. It's quite attractive if you're poor in Colombia or some other conflict affected country. Joining a DDR program is quite attractive for many people. There were 32,000 people who joined. They only landed in 18,000 guns, which means they probably staked significant amounts of guns, which were then being used by successor groups to paramilitaries. And they had no specific track or incentives for the mid-level commanders in the paramilitaries initially. And a lot of these people said, either I take a minimum wage here or I go back to the criminal activities I was involved in before and I become a leader of a successor group who control a lot of the coca trade in Colombia. So a lot of them did. If you compare this to demobilization of FARC, there was between 1,000 and 3,000 people leaving every year. The government had almost a very good insight into the identities of the fighters. It were quite easy for them to weed out people who said they were combatants but weren't, because they knew all the sort of the names of the commanders. And if you show up, they would show you a photo of the commander, who's this? And if you can't answer that question, in all likelihood, you're not part of the group, and so forth. And they offered payments if people gave up arms caches and so forth. And so this is a bit of an ironic outcome. It turns out it's been much easier to reintegrate a state-hostile group such as FARC. The results have been so far quite clearly more positive for reintegrating them than it was to reintegrate the paramilitaries who were primarily fighting the guerrillas. I'm not saying they were state-friendly, but at least they weren't targeting the state. And if you look at, there's been, in terms of DDR programs, there's been a shift from thinking this is the magic bullet that is absolutely necessary for every peace agreement, and if this is successful, everything else will follow, to a much more nuanced discussion about the pros and cons of DDR and the limits. If you look at the DDR programs that I just described in Colombia, on the national level, in terms of national level security and stability, they have been arguably successful insofar that when the paramilitaries were deemed clear shift in decrease in homicides, in forced displacements, in kidnappings, not all of this is due to the paramilitaries demobilizing. It's a multi-causal phenomenon, but it's quite clear that on the national level, the net effect has been positive. Likewise with FARC. FARC has lost somewhere between half and two-thirds of its fighting unit. Not all of this is related to defectors, but it's again, it's been a very significant contribution to the de-escalation of the conflict in Colombia. And if you ask intelligence analysts or if you ask ex-combatants if FARC is negotiating today, most of them will say because they've been weakened both by the army on the battlefield but also by the reintegration. People are tired of being guerrilla, and they trust the reintegration program to provide, if not a very good life, at least better. Thank you. Then if you go down to the individual level, it's not the results are much more mixed in terms of reintegration. There's been 40% of people enter integration have left, and we know no good answers of what happened to them. There's been major security problems, especially for the paramilitaries. And as I said, some of the former leaders of the paramilitaries are today leaders of criminal organizations. And the point I'm making here with the third column, the collective demobilization of FARC, is that if you look at experiences from the demobilization of the paramilitaries and individual FARC fighters, there are some quite predictable consequences if FARC was to demobilize collectively. And I'll just I'll get back to them during the questions and answers, but you can see violence against ex-combatants, the risk of remobilization of entire units who remain involved in drug trafficking. That's the main ones. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.